If there's one thing I value above hard work, modesty, and baseball, it's a great cup of coffee. And like most coffee lovers, I know that the secret to the best cup of coffee is freshly roasted beans. But the beans you get at most grocery stores and coffee shops could have spent months on the shelves before you got it. So you'll be delighted to hear that the internet has solved this problem for you with Sparkplug Coffee. Sparkplug uses only premium Arabica beans directly sourced and fairly traded. They have many blends and roasts to choose from, including half-calf and decaf. But the best part is that Sparkplug always delivers this coffee right to your door within a week of being custom roasted right here in Toronto, so that it's always fresh and at its peak flavor. You can even take advantage of their autopilot set-it-and-forget-it delivery so that you'll never run out of fresh coffee again. It's time for your favorite cup of coffee to start coming from your own kitchen. So plug yourself in at sparkplugcoffee.com. You'll consider yourself the luckiest coffee drinker on the face of the earth.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Project.
And action.
Hiya, Flick fans. We tip our cap to you for tuning in to the next 100 project as we keep pecking away at non-American Film Institute motion pictures. You should be warned that revealing spoilers are not dirty pool around here. They call me Ryan Ellis, the aging first baseman with a wonderfully supportive wife, and that wife's name is Eleanor. I should say Bev.
That's me.
Yeah, her name's Bev. So anyway, before we get going on this podcast, a note about previous podcasts. In fact, the wrap-up end of December last year, I said a certain number of women directors had directed AFI-nominated films. Of course, no woman directed a film that made the AFI's top 100 lists. And you pointed out one in your guessing during Big last week, if we directed one on each list. Of course, Penny Marshall, Amy Heckerling, and Nora Ephron were those three. Randa Haynes, who did Children of a Lesser God. I forgot that was a woman. I saw the name, overlooked it entirely. So, for those who may have noticed that way back then in the wrap-up podcast, add a woman's name to that list. There's one more that we didn't know about. So, maybe it isn't quite as bad as we thought it was. It's still pretty bad. Women are overlooked way too often.
Sorry, Randa.
Okay, the coming attractions trivia for this week's picture, The Pride of the Yankees. How many of the 37 quotes that ranked higher than Lou Gehrig's famous "Today, I consider myself the luckiest man on the face of the earth" speech are, like Gehrig's quote, spoken by real people?
I forgot to look it up. Five?
Just throwing a number out there.
Yep. Yeah.
None.
What?
That's
really?
The highest ranked real person quote. The only other one I could even find that is even loosely based on a real quote is Tom Hanks' character in Apollo 13, where it's, "Houston, we have a problem." The actual quote was, "Houston, we've had a problem." Jim Lovell, the astronaut, said that. But that's the only other one on the entire list I can even find that's at all legitimately based on a real quote at all. And Pride of the Yankees was higher ranked of those two.
And if you're going to be that particular about it, the Pride of the Yankees isn't dead on exactly how Lou Gehrig said it either, is it?
The speech he gave, yeah, they did tweak that a lot. That line, as I recall, is accurate. And it's close enough. Like I just said, "Houston, we've had a problem" isn't quite the same as "Houston, we have a problem." In both cases, it's close enough.
You're splitting hairs, I think.
But Godfather quotes, On the Waterfront quotes, Gone with the Wind, Casablanca, none of these are real people. So that's the point. The quotes list, not real people being referenced. All right, so the next 100 Project's 12th movie, The Pride of the Yankees, was nominated for both AFI Top 100s, but of course did not make it. After some summer previews in New York and Los Angeles in 1942, RKO and the Goldwyn Company rolled the movie out in March 1943, but we do think of it as a 1942 picture. It did pretty well and finished 10th at the box office in 42. But I don't think people really know much about the Pride of the Yankees, Bev, so explain that to them right now with the skinny.
Gary Cooper is Yankees' great Lou Gehrig in this biopic that shows Gehrig's life from his precocious youth through college and then all through his Hall of Fame career, ending with the final time he appeared in Yankee Stadium. Teresa Wright is his monumentally loving wife, Eleanor, and Walter Brennan is Lou's close friend, New York reporter Sam Blake.
Or in a nutshell, isn't it ironic that Lou Gehrig got Lou Gehrig's disease?
Why me?
How could this have happened? And what a coincidence. All right, so the critical response from Rotten Tomatoes, 92% of them liked the movie, only 23 fresh, so obviously not a lot of reviews, 2 rotten, and 89% of audiences. And at the box office, I said it was number 10. Mrs. Miniver, which won the Oscar in 1942 for Best Picture, was number 1, and Yankee Doodle Dandy, which we covered way back when, the Top 100 Project, was number 2. Casablanca, interestingly, it technically is 1942. It won the Oscar in 1943 for Best Picture and Best Director and so on. And when you look online, it's listed with the 43 films. It's very confusing. So it's a 42 movie, but it's also a 43 movie. Anyway, that's all not really the point. So, The Pride of the Yankees, not a movie Bev would necessarily pick, a baseball movie, but it is opening day as of yesterday. So what'd you think of The Pride of the Yankees?
It's true, I would never pick this movie. And I really didn't know all that much going into it. Actually, I didn't really know all that much about Lou Gehrig. And it's funny that it came out the same year as Yankee Doodle Dandy, because they are so similar. It's another biopic that's just gutless and corny and really over-sentimental, yet totally watchable. You know, you make a film that's this squeaky clean, as like a testament to monotony and clean living and hard work, you'd expect it to be pretty dull, but it's not. It's so sweet and tender, and somehow it turns its virtual lack of conflict into an asset.
When it was over, I looked at you and said, what'd you think? And I thought I would get a meh response from you, but instead you said, I really liked it.
It's very charming.
Well, Frank Capra was not involved, but this one has a bowlful of cornball stuff in it. I don't remember the actual history of Lou Gehrig himself, if he was quite this clean. I think he was pretty clean in general.
I don't think anybody could possibly.
But the Gary Cooper version, yes, he does not make mistakes. He is absolutely a Boy Scout the whole way through. One of the nice touches that Gary Cooper gives to it, maybe it's something that the director Sam Wood and he came up with, I don't really know. He's always got that little boy smile right to the very end. He's in his mid to late 30s when the movie is coming to an end, and he still has that Boy Scout sensibility that's almost kind of charming, because the guy's a megastar in his sport and kind of a megastar in the whole world, and yet he still acts like he's just a regular kind of dude, and I guess he is.
He still has that innocence.
So it is a baseball movie, but much like a lot of other sports movies, it isn't really about the big game. There are plenty of big games in this movie. They reference them. The movie is actually fairly accurate to the Yankees' history, Lou Gehrig's history, Babe Ruth's history, and so on. But this isn't about the big game. And I did find it interesting when I looked through the list of the sports movies on the genres list, the 10 of them, and just sports movies in general, just thinking about them that didn't make that top 10. Sports movies are usually love stories. They're not necessarily even about the sport they're involved with. The Hustler is more of a failed love story. Rocky is about a successful love story. Raging Bull is not a love story, but it's not really about boxing at all. There's maybe 10 minutes of it in the whole movie. Field of Dreams is one of the great sports movies of all time. I think most people would say that who love baseball, like fantasy and that kind of stuff. Also kind of modern Capra-esque sort of movie in a way. Not really about baseball. It's way more about the people. And The Pride of the Yankees fits into that category too.
Yeah, I guess the AFI doesn't really reward those sports movies that are just about a ragtag individual or group that by all rights shouldn't have a chance, but through moxie and the power of montage beat the far superior yet totally evil team and get the girl while they're at it.
Every sports movie needs a montage, and this one has more than a few.
With actual baseball footage from the actual games that Lou Gehrig played, which could have partially been because, I mean, the authenticity is nice, but also because Gary Cooper, as good of an actor as he is, couldn't really pull off being a baseball player. He didn't look like an athlete.
There are all kinds of stories online that they had to flip the footage of him batting left-handed because as bad as an athlete as he was anyway, he could not bat left-handed. Then I was reading just recently that wasn't true. A historian actually looked into this and said, no, he just couldn't throw left-handed, so there's not that much footage of him throwing anyway. But when there is, he threw right-handed. They flipped the footage to make that look left-handed because the baseball expert they got, was it Lefty O'Doul? I forget his name now. I think that was him. Said the guy was awful at that, but he batted left-handed well enough that they can make it believable. And they don't show that much footage of him playing ball anyway. We won't get too far into the baseball stuff of this because I could talk about that all day and you don't care, and most of our listeners probably don't either. But I did like there were nice details about old-time baseball where the gloves are left on the field.
Really?
Did you not notice that?
No. Yeah.
That's actually true. I don't know when it stopped being a thing, but around the time of the 30s for sure, and way before that, of course, the left fielder, the first baseman, whoever it was, would leave their glove on the field to go to the dugout. And when they'd go back out, the glove would still be there. So either team would do that, and I don't know why they would because it'd be in the way. There had to have been times where the ball, or even just running for the ball, it would get in the way of one of those two things.
Yeah, especially in second base or in the outfield. That's crazy.
That's also in Eight Men Out, another great baseball movie in 1988 where they throw the gloves on the field and they walk off. And as I said a few minutes ago, the on-field situations in the game itself are pretty accurate. They don't have every single game the Yankees ever played that meant anything. Gehrig and Ruth and that team won a lot of World Series. And for those who care about baseball, I will say this much more before I get too far into this. Gehrig played with Babe Ruth, who preceded him on the Yankees. Then Ruth retired. Gehrig played on, then he had Joe DiMaggio on his team, and then DiMaggio had Mantle on his team, so that epic era of those four players, four of the greatest of all time, overlapped in some ways, one or another.
I recognize those names, therefore I'm impressed.
We'll come back to baseball stats in a minute because there's one thing we have to mention before the podcast ends, and those who know anything about Lou Gehrig know what that number is in particular. But let's get into propaganda for a minute here, because this movie came out right around the time when America was getting into the war finally that was happening over in Europe. This is not a wartime story. It has nothing to do with that. In fact, everything that takes place is before the war even started, I think, in Europe, and certainly before America was even close to getting involved after Pearl Harbor. But it's a wartime movie because it was released in 42 and then more specifically in 43 when the war was really at its peak for America. And that is acknowledged in the opening credits. But is it propaganda?
They open with a title credit saying, "This is a movie about heroes, just like our boys overseas, fighting for the cause." It's absolutely a propaganda film. America's so confused about who they want to be their heroes, and in this movie they're pretty explicit about making the connection between what makes Gehrig a hero is what makes the soldiers fighting overseas heroes. They don't talk about it a lot in the movie, but they do open with that card so that it's on your mind. Gehrig is the hero America wishes it worshipped. You know, he works hard and achieves amazing, admirable things. On paper, he's the American dream, but in reality, I think popular American heroes are much more likely to be admired for risk-taking and
or
charisma.
Babe Ruth.
Babe Ruth, his teammate, exactly.
Who was not an honorable guy, not nearly as much as Gehrig was, anyway.
The blowhard and, like, a guy who loved being famous, which is more like the American celebrity. I think people, you know, I am not a baseball fan, but I'm far more familiar with Babe Ruth than I ever have been with Lou Gehrig because he's kind of boring. But during the war, I can see how that head-down, hard-working, devoted guy would be the type of person that they would want to celebrate, because those are the type of guys that were people's brothers and sons who went overseas, were fighting, and who were dying. Like, Lou Gehrig died, too. So the country's in mourning for all these heroes. There's absolutely a connection.
Gehrig was just shy of 38 when he died in June 1941, so only a few months before Pearl Harbor. And Gary Cooper was about the same age as Lou Gehrig. And that really does show in the college scenes when he's at Columbia. He does not look like he's 18, 19 or so years old, obviously.
He looks older than he is.
He is one of those actors. We said that during Big, just last week, that I said De Niro kind of always looked a little bit older than he really was in movies, and maybe he couldn't have played the 30-year-old version of Josh. But Tom Hanks, certainly in 1988, didn't look like he was 30-ish, and I think he actually was around that age. And De Niro was older than Hanks, granted, but he also seemed older.
Yeah,
and yes,
yeah.
Gary Cooper seems older than other actors.
I mean, he has crow's feet all the way to his ears, and he's, like, pledging in a fraternity.
I think it's all the cigarette smoking and booze drinking those guys did. Not that actors don't do that now, but then we've covered that in podcasts plenty of times about how the guys now look so cut. Ten Commandments, that's what it was. Because Heston and Brenner, for 1950s, are so buff. Because that's the way you look back then. You weren't cut to the gills like Ryan Reynolds. And yet, Ryan Reynolds is not really an outlier. The outlier would be if you looked like Charlton Heston and had your shirt off. What's with you? You look okay at best. Most guys now, even if they're 38 or 40 years old like I am, or I'm older than that, are going to be cut to the nines in their chest and that kind of thing. So that's
the way
people look now.
And massive bulging muscles and protruding abs. And
somehow also looking younger than they really are. Matt Damon, does he look like he's 46 this year, I think he's supposed to be? Does Matt Damon look like he's about that old?
Do you think that Matt Damon is above getting Botox?
That's true.
Yeah,
Gary Cooper, John Wayne, Jimmy Stewart, they didn't have that option.
Yeah,
that's
absolutely.
True. Right. Okay, so back into the movie, though. We talked a few minutes ago about the war effort. This is also a cliché story of the German immigrant, ironically, the Gehrig family were from Germany, and the mother who wants her son not to be an athlete, or not to do something that she didn't intend for him to do. He's got to be an engineer, and then as the movie plays out, she actually is one of his biggest fans and learns about the game. Not really a funny sequence the way it's supposed to be, but a cute sequence where she knows terminology that the father doesn't even know, yet earlier on she didn't understand anything about, why are there pillows on the field? Of course, bases.
She's like the closest thing to any conflict that the movie ever gets, because they have to lie to her about how he's making money to pay for her surgery, and then when he gets married, there's a conflict where she wants to decorate their house, but Eleanor naturally wants to decorate her own home. But none of these conflicts last more than to the next scene.
Well, it seems like it might have played out for years in reality, but in the movie's language, no, it isn't very long.
There's no big overarching conflict. In a way, it's nice that they didn't create silly, contrived conflicts like a lot of biopics do, a lot of historical movies do, in a way that can come across as really phony. In that respect, it's nice.
The conflict is safe for the very end when something happens to him that he cannot control. These parents were not literally, but pretty much reprised in The Searchers. Do you remember those parents? The Swedish characters?
Oh, yeah.
Of Vera Miles' character in the film?
Yeah.
It's kind of a Hollywood cliche where it's the immigrant parents, but they've got to be like they are in both this movie and The Searchers. And I kind of wish Lou had just psychoed his mother early on and gotten on with his life, because she's not anywhere near as bad as that mother. But after a little while, you gotta say, he's making money and he's good at this. Let him be who he is. And I guess maybe that's the point. She does realize that after a while and becomes a big supporter of his baseball career, as she should. And I do want to say a few more things about the baseball career. I'll do it right now. Here's the number everyone knows from Lou Gehrig. The 2,130 consecutive game streak. That's a decade plus of never missing a game. And when Cal Ripken of the Orioles broke that in the mid-90s, that was just after the baseball strike in 94. People have said this many times. The two things that saved baseball from, maybe not going under, but from becoming a minor league sport in a sense compared to basketball and football, which had been gaining anyway, and soccer internationally and so many other things. Baseball was saved by two main things. The home run chase between Mark McGwire and Sammy Sosa in 1998. And Cal Ripken breaking Gehrig's streak in 96. Oh, I forget the year now. Maybe the streak that they both had isn't as impressive as a lot of people want to make it out to be. But it is something else to never miss a day of work. A lot of people said, oh, you just go show up to play. But that's also, especially in Ripken's case, I think it was true about Gehrig too. You're starting every game. It's not a matter of just getting one at bat or something like that. Just appearing. And baseball players, more than other sports, do play through injuries because they're maybe not as serious. A football player gets hurt, he's probably really hurt and cannot possibly function. Or a boxer is his brain scrambled. A hockey player is a broken foot, whatever it might be. Baseball players play almost every single day, so they're of course going to play through all kinds of little wounds and injuries. So it is an impressive number, and that's the thing people think of with Lou Gehrig. The incredible numbers in general, he's a Hall of Famer for a good reason. He's got all kinds of unbelievable numbers, including having one of the best batting averages of all time, and people think of him as a slugger, but he was a great hitter in general. Then there's a scene in the movie, which apparently is based on reality, where he pledges to hit home runs for a boy in the hospital. Oh, gosh!
Oh, talk about
it's cornball, but I have heard that's based on reality. Babe Ruth does it for the cameras, Lou Gehrig does it for the kid. The cameras leave and Babe Ruth leaves, Lou Gehrig stays behind, and then, of course, you've got Walter Brennan, eh? Watching him say, you know what, Billy, I'm going to hit a couple home runs for you today.
Well, he said, I'm going to hit a home run for you, and then this greedy little kid, hey, why don't you hit two?
In the World Series, too.
Dude.
South Park has parodied so many things in their history, and one of them has to be the whole thing where it's, can you actually make it so I don't have cancer anymore? Cough, cough. Rather than actually hitting home runs for me, because that doesn't mean much. But then, I'd forgotten, I hadn't seen this movie in a long time, it does pay off at the end, where he's a grown man, he shows up at the end, when Lou's going to give his last speech at Yankee Stadium, and it's, you saved me, you made me walk again.
This was one piece of corn too far
Frank
for
Capra
me.
Frank Capra would have been proud.
Oh my god, a home run does not save a kid from polio. And so, maybe that happened, maybe that kid recovered, but the movie's clearly like, obviously he recovered because Lou Gehrig hit a home run, you guys. He's a baseball player. If you want to make a movie about saving children, make a movie about a doctor, and then I'll buy it.
Gehrig corn rather than Capricorn.
Oh, man alive, that was bad.
But speaking of his disease that pays off at the very end, it is amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, which is the ALS we all know, Lou Gehrig's disease. It probably isn't tough or noble to keep this looming death from your wife as they portray in the film.
And apparently it's not even true. In reality, she learned about it and her and the doctor colluded to keep the truth from him.
Oh.
And said that he had a 50-50 chance of getting right back to his old self again.
What's curious about that whole deal is that how do they know what might happen to him when it was a brand new disease?
But it wasn't a brand new disease.
Well, why'd they call it Lou Gehrig's disease if it wasn't new to everybody?
I don't know, because everybody found out about it through Lou Gehrig?
Popularized.
Well, that's one thing
about this movie. We talked about it being propaganda. The Pride of the Yankees would have been an aid to getting the word out there about ALS, something that people wouldn't know much about.
Thousands of people die of ALS every year. Are you telling me that Lou Gehrig invented it? Is he a hero?
He's in the Hall of Fame for all kinds of reasons. That's one of the reasons why.
Surely people got ALS before Lou Gehrig.
Nope.
And he's just probably the person who made it famous.
I don't care if I'm accurate on this case.
He's like Kanye West to Taylor Swift, you know? People kind of knew about it, but it really blew up after Lou Gehrig touched it.
I'm going to let you finish previous ALS getters, but after the actual Gehrig got the disease, there was a fast turnaround with the film. We've talked about that a lot in our podcast, especially with the Top 100 Project films. The classic novels got turned into movies in about a year or two, usually about 2 years it took, which is still very fast for them to write a screenplay, get everything in place, make the movie, and release it in a couple years is impressive enough. This one premiered about a year after Gehrig died.
Was it in the works when he was still sick?
I didn't read that, but he died in the summer of 41. And then they first premiered, like I said earlier, in the summer of 42.
It's a good business model. You got to strike when the iron's hot, and it still happens. You still see things like Hunger Games, Gone Girl. It's still a great way to get people out to the theater when you have a popular book and you have that audience waiting for a product.
Except this is based on somebody's life, no book
whatsoever.
Sure,
sure. But I'm sure that if next year somebody came out with the Rob Ford story, a public figure who recently died, I bet lots of people would clamor out to the movie to see it when it's still fresh in everyone's mind.
If they're going to, that's the time to do it with Rob Ford, because he will fade, as he should.
It would be a very different story, a very different movie.
Yeah, there's no luckiest man there. He would say he was taken advantage of and ignored and not respected and all the rest. So let's get into that famous speech at the end, which was changed quite a bit for the film. The spirit of it remains. In the reality, he said the luckiest man line at the beginning of the speech. In the movie, it's the last line of the speech. But one thing I really liked about the speech, in both versions, he says something to the effect of, "My friends in the press." Would you ever hear an athlete say that today?
I don't know, would you?
Probably not.
Is there a lot of animosity?
Way too much antagonism goes on in the press with athletes today, and some of it is absolutely toxic. But even the ones that are more political, say Wayne Gretzky when he retired, he might have said something like that. Possibly Gretzky would have. I don't recall if he did. But Lou Gehrig made a point of it, saying, "My friends in the press," just seems so Boy Scoutish, I guess. So perfect. Really, you actually like the press? Because they weren't exactly nice even then. The one character, Dan Duryea, plays him. He was a guy who was in a lot of Westerns, and then, of course, his next movie has nothing to do with Westerns. But he's Walter Brennan's co-worker, who's always so cynical about
him.
And I'm sure the media, in general, was more like him than the very supportive Sam Blake character that Brennan plays, where it's, no matter what he does, he's a good guy. I gotta show you how much a good guy he is.
Now, we are talking about a historical figure who, to this day, nobody ever released any dirt on him, so maybe he does have some friends in the press. He had some good PR going on for him. He has the most squeaky clean reputation of possibly any athlete in history.
And isn't it interesting that last week we did Big, starring Tom Hanks, now Lou Gehrig being played by an actor, but Hanks and Gehrig, unless their PR teams, like you said, and Big, are just that good, they seem to be above reproach. Or they just don't screw up. They really are that good a person. The last line of the movie, though, is not the luckiest man on the face of the earth. The last line of the movie is by some off-screen actor playing an umpire who says, "Play ball!" So that means the movie ends on a bittersweet note. The game goes on. Babe Ruth had retired. They show him in the movie plenty of times, including at the end. Gehrig obviously is retired at this point in the film. The Yankees continue on. Now they've got Joe DiMaggio and other great players. They're going to keep on being a good franchise, as they were. But sorry, dude, the game, the Yankees, we're going to keep on going without you, even though you're going to die of this horrible disease, even though we're giving you an entire day to yourself that fills Yankee Stadium with the 50-plus thousand people. I like that, though, because it's not as Hollywood as an ending can be for an otherwise very Hollywood movie.
It can't end happily. The man had just died, and
it could have found a way to have some kind of love scene with his wife. Oh, we're going to be okay. We're going to go and do our thing in New York City without baseball. We'll be happy. And then the little key at the end, they actually died kind of thing.
It's still a sad note. I like that it ends on play ball because he was a man who loved few things, and one of them was baseball. He just loved baseball that much.
He would have wanted the game to go on without
him, absolutely.
I think. Most athletes would. They know the game is bigger than them, whatever the sport is, not just baseball. So are the cast. Gary Cooper, he won Oscars for Sergeant York the year before this movie, actually, and then High Noon, which we covered on the Top 100 Project, and he also won an honorary award, so a guy who is well-regarded by the Oscars in their history. You've seen him twice now. Maybe you've seen other Gary Cooper movies beyond that. What have you thought of him so far?
I've only seen the two Gary Cooper movies. I don't think I've ever seen anything else he's been in. Well, what I've seen, I think he's a really good actor, especially by 1940s standards. He has a real naturalness about him. And the difference between Lou Gehrig and the character he plays in High Noon, you barely recognize it. Like, he has that chameleon way about him. But he still, in both movies, embodies this ideal American hero, right? He's the strong, white, male, stoic, brave, and he has this quiet confidence in both films. And he's a massive star, and I can see why that would appeal to a lot of people. Certainly, Hollywood executives, it's very easy to sell persona.
High Noon was thought by some people, including John Wayne and Howard Hawks, to be a left-leaning communism-enabling film. And yet John Wayne accepted the Oscar for Gary Cooper in 1952. Well, I guess because he was friends with them, and yet he didn't agree with the politics of the film.
But Gary Cooper was a staunch conservative. He was a Republican. He campaigned for Dewey. He testified for the House of Un-American Activities. He didn't name names, but he insinuated that the threat was real and that he had colleagues who were very, quote-unquote, un-American.
And I mentioned Jimmy Stewart a few minutes ago. He was also a staunch Republican in these days. And may have been more of a rat kind of person than we ever want to believe about Jimmy Stewart. We mentioned Tom Hanks. Well, he's often compared to Jimmy Stewart. And I don't think Hanks would do those kinds of things to his colleagues. Cooper is 17 years. Teresa Wright. Hey, we haven't even mentioned her yet. Eleanor, Teresa Wright. 17 years her senior. This is not uncommon in Hollywood. That is almost two decades. That's a lot of years to be older than somebody. This actress was Oscar nominated for her first three movies, including Pride of the Yankees. That's pretty impressive. But then she's also in Best Years of Her Lives a few years after this, an AFI movie we covered. And the year after this movie, Shadow of a Doubt, the Hitchcock film I've told you about a few times that we got to watch because it's one of Hitchcock's best. And apparently, according to people, that Hitchcock thought of his own movies, it was his best. The actual Ellie was very touched by how accurate Cooper was, and she loved the whole movie.
She's as uncomplicated as everything else in this film, but she has the charisma to pull it off, to be interesting to watch, regardless of the lack of conflict. And that's really what she had to bring to it, was to just be delightful, and she was. She seems very lovable, and their relationship with each other was incredibly convincing.
Like I said earlier, you got to have a good person to play off of. You're going to have a movie that's about a love story with a background of sports, because like all sports movies, there are so many of them. That's the point, not the sporting events.
And because the actual Eleanor approved of the film and helped get it made, that helped to make her character that much more complete and kind of like a full-fledged human being. And she was a pretty well-written wife. For the 40s, especially.
Yeah, she wasn't hectoring on him. She wasn't giving him a hard time about anything. She gives him all the compliments of the things that he's accomplished in the field. And his response is to say, she's the greatest wife, and she's this, and she's that. Again, kind of cornball, but very nice.
You and I have a pretty happy marriage, but if we ever had a day like that, it would only be under the influence of some magical drug. They are so ridiculously happy after all those years of marriage.
If I got a horseshoe of roses for how good I was in the field, you would be honoring that all night long. We talk about you very briefly.
All, I would attend your game. It's so weird she doesn't go to the game. She just hangs out at home and makes dinner.
Okay, well, I mentioned Walter Brennan a few times, and if you don't know that name, it's because you haven't seen the westerns he was known for, especially with John Wayne. Oh, Walter Brennan, yeah. He won three Oscars, all in the supporting role, before this movie came out. I think he was actually the first ever actor to win a supporting actor Oscar. That was the year they invented it. It was 1936. Oh. I think I'm right about that. I hope so. He's based on a real guy named Fred Lieb, a sports writer. I don't know, but that's what I saw online. And then you talk about real people, Babe Ruth. Bill Dickey, actual Yankees who played themselves. Babe Ruth is in the movie quite a bit.
He's a good actor, too.
So they're not bad, anyway.
Yeah.
He was in his mid-40s at this point. He had retired from the Boston Braves, which was his last team. He was not finishing his career at the Yankees. If people know much about Babe Ruth, he started with the Red Sox and was sold to them. More baseball trivia. And that's why people say that the Curse of the Bambino was in effect. Well, it was until 2004 when the Red Sox finally won the World Series after 90-some-odd years, 80-some-odd years, I guess it was. Because they sold this great player who was mostly a pitcher back then, and then the Yankees went on to be a world championship team time after time after time because of people like Ruth, Gehrig, DiMaggio, Mantle, and so on. But back to Ruth in this era, he only lived to 53 himself, wasn't that much older than Gehrig was, but he did get his own movie in 1948, The Babe Ruth Story. He did see it just before he died, didn't stand out nearly as much as this movie did, obviously. We're not planning to cover that one. So Sam Wood is the director. We talked about him so long ago when we did A Night at the Opera for the Top 100 Project. He was the director of the Marx Brothers.
Oh!
And I remember reading then, Groucho didn't like him because he was too stiff. If this movie's guilty of anything, it's that it's too stiff.
Mm.
Lou Gehrig himself, the way they portray him, is very stiff. Wood's also known for Goodbye, Mr. Chips in 1939. There have been a few versions of that one, but that was the one that won Robert Donat an Oscar over Jimmy Stewart. Name comes up again in this podcast. And here's an interesting number for Wood in 1942. He also made King's Row, which was nominated for the 1942 Best Picture Oscar against Pride of the Yankees, Mrs. Miniver, and others. And then Sam Wood himself was nominated for Best Director for King's Row. So that was a huge year for that guy. And he made so many movies. Look up his credits. They're pretty impressive. And here's something we haven't seen in a long time. I don't recall it since 1941 with Citizen Kane, where the director shares a title card with, in this case, the production designer. And Kane, it was with the cinematographer. That made sense because... Mm-hmm. Greg Toland shot an unbelievably great-looking film, and Wells was giving him credit for that.
Yeah, and it was his first time directing Wells, so he probably didn't know what he was doing and got a lot of help.
And the way they portray it, whether it's true or not, in RKO 2A1, the making of the Citizen Kane movie, Toland was a co-director in effect.
Mm-hmm.
He was really giving Wells direction on where they put the camera, how they do this, how they do that. The production design in Pride of the Yankees is good, but I don't know why he's sharing a title credit with the director. There was a time in the 30s when the director's credit was buried amongst everybody else, but not by 1942. That was when they started, before this in fact, where they have the director be the last credit, or if not the last, then the second last, because maybe the producer would get the very last title card. So production design's fine, but why it gets to share it with the director, I don't know. But hey, good for the production designer William Cameron Menzies for getting that. So the writers, Joe Swerling, Herman Mankiewicz, who did write, or at least co-wrote, Citizen Kane.
Mm-hmm.
The producer, Samuel Goldwyn, 42 years of doing that. We covered him for Wuthering Heights and The Best Years of Our Lives. So obviously, like Teresa Wright, to have helped cast her again in a later movie. He's the guy that thought baseball movies were box office poison, and yet here he is producing one that did quite well. The movie is 1:3:3:1, of course, back in this era. It wouldn't be widescreen. We watched the DVD, which was mediocre looking, but it is old. Black and white. We've seen a few black and white movies lately. Wages of Fear and now this. Cinematographer Rudolf Matthay, who shot Foreign Correspondent for Hitchcock, and To Be or Not to Be, a very funny movie from 1942. Also, the editor, the only Oscar winner in this entire group. Right. Daniel Mandel, who we've talked about before, because he cut The Best Years of Our Lives and The Apartment, and he also cut Wuthering Heights, so Goldwyn obviously used him plenty of times, 3 AFI movies and 3 Oscars for Best Years, Apartment, and for Pride of the Yankees.
It's probably because of him. He's probably the thing that put it over the edge and made it great.
We like to talk about editing because that's what you do for a living. What did you think of his editing?
Oh, well, the film is really excellently paced, considering there isn't a plot to speak of. It has an incredible flow. I mean, a lot of that has to be script as well, but that definitely takes place in the edit suite as well.
Pretty good pace, yeah, I'll give you that. The music score, Lee Harline, who's known for Disney stuff. Snow White, Pinocchio, and then this person actually wrote When You Wish Upon a Star. Now, a section we always like to talk about, and I don't have much this time, influence. I guess the movie helped to get the word out to the public about ALS by having a movie in the theaters, and a pretty successful one at that. Now in the modern era, the last couple years, the Ice Bucket Challenge that supports ALS research.
I don't know if that's because of this movie.
No, but I'm reaching, I admit that.
I mean, it's not a movie that reinvents the wheel at all. It's working from a pretty well-worn formula, so there's only so many ways it could have influence on things that were made after that. It's always talk about innovators and perfectors. It's a perfecter of...
Yeah.
Of a formula rather than an innovator.
But if baseball movies were box office poison, if that was actually true, then this one, I guess, influenced baseball movies because they would have been made. And the Babe Ruth story maybe wouldn't have been made had it not been for the successful version of the Lou Gehrig story.
And lionizing a baseball hero helps cement baseball as the American sport.
Mm. But here's a section that is pretty lengthy, the awards and AFI lists. So it won the Oscar for Mandel's editing. 10 nominations that didn't win. Best Picture. Best Actor for Cooper, Best Actress for Wright, Best Story, Best Screenplay, Best Cinematography, the sets, the sound, the special effects, and the music score. And 4 successful AFI bids. It was 38th on the top 100 quotes with the Today I Consider Myself, etc., etc. 25th on the Nice Guy side of the Heroes and Villains list for Lou Gehrig. 22nd on the top 100 Cheers, Most Inspiring. Yeah, it's pretty inspiring, I guess. And it was 3rd in the sports category of the top 100 genres. Number 1 and number 2 were, if you recall...
Raging Bull and Rocky.
That's right, 2 boxing movies. The only other baseball movie on that top 10 was Bull Durham at number 5, and that's the movie that we considered doing, at least I considered doing, because I guess I picked this movie. And I almost wanted to do that instead, or even Field of Dreams, but I thought we should get back to the 40s, or at least an old movie, and also one that's so regarded by the AFI with all these lists. So Bull Durham is in there, and it should be, and it's a better movie, and I will watch that one dozens of more times before I die. Not so much Pride of the Yankees.
Maybe we'll get to it next spring.
Yeah, the baseball movie when we get into opening day in 2017. So your final thoughts on The Pride of the Yankees?
You know, I'm a big film buff, and I have been for decades, and this is just not a movie that's ever made it into my consciousness. It's not a film that people in our generation ever talk about. So it's surprising to me to hear these numbers and hear how well-regarded it still is. I think it probably made a far bigger impression on the older generation, you know, our parents and older, the people who really are the voters in AFI and as well as the Academy. Their average age is really old. I suspect this movie's probably going to leave public consciousness when the next generation turns over, which is a shame because it was a truly delightful way to spend 2 hours. Mm-hmm. Even though I'm not a baseball person and this is not the type of movie I typically enjoy, what can I say? It was very charismatic. It won me over. It was very sweet and heartwarming.
And for the record, the modern version of The Pride of the Yankees would have to be Derek Jeter, who also, at least so far, has had a squeaky clean image. Not dying, of course, he's alive and well, but retired after a great career. And as I say, publicly, not much is known about him in any kind of negative sorts of ways. There will be stories maybe as the years go on with him, and he's not going to get that tragic, he just died, let's make a movie about him kind of thing.
It's a lot harder to keep a secret now than it was in the 30s and 40s.
Mm-hmm.
So it'd be next to impossible to keep a squeaky clean reputation.
Well, they show Babe Ruth when he first comes to the movie eating hot dogs, and that was the cliche about him, is that he didn't care about his body. He didn't bother to pretend to be honorable back when he was in the game, including eating hot dogs before and during games. Not exactly the way you should handle yourself as a professional athlete. But he was lionized because he was so great and also because he was charismatic. But yes, his scandals were buried by the press. from what we're hearing in our research and what we heard way back in the time when it was actually true, Garrick didn't have anything to bury.
Mm-hmm.
But it does make him a little boring. And he's played by an actor who I've never been the biggest fan of. I think Cooper's good. I don't think he's one of the best. And knowing Jimmy Stewart's past, like we talked about a little bit in this podcast, gives him an extra edge in a strange kind of way. When I watch It's Wonderful Life and think that he leans to the side of people that nowadays certainly would be like Mr. Potter in It's Wonderful Life, a right-wing, hardcore, I don't care about anybody kind of banker, and yet he was on the side. Although, then again, back in those days, that was not the way Republicans were.
Yeah, I think being a Republican was a different thing.
Oh, we're getting political at the end of this podcast.
Yeah.
We weren't planning to. Anyway, pretty good sports movie, but we're back in the 40s briefly. We're going to get back into the 50s again, our third time so far on the Next 100 Project, because in Seven Sunrises on the Next 100 Project, we have a 61-year-old black and white picture about juvenile delinquents. Blackboard Jungle. So the coming attractions trivia for Blackboard Jungle. Name three major films or TV shows that also featured the song Rock Around the Clock. 1, 2, 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock, rock, boom.
Okay, well, I can think of one right off the top of my head that's a really easy one. But for the answer to that question, please tune into next week's podcast. If you'd like more from Ryan and me, please visit our website, top100project.com. Don't forget to subscribe to the Top 100 Project on iTunes. While you're there, rate us, review us. It helps people find us, and we love that. And while you're there, you can check out any of the 123 movies that we podcasted for the AFI's two Top 100 lists. And if you'd like to reach Ryan and me, we're both on Twitter. I am at BevEllisEllis. Ryan is at MovieFiend51.
Sometimes.
Yeah, we're not actually very devoted Twitterers. If you'd like to reach us privately, we always take care to respond to emails, and we love to hear from you guys. Email us at top100projectpodcast@gmail.com. And once more, before we go, I would like to warmly thank our sponsor, sparkplugcoffee.com.
In honor of this movie, I guess the last word has to be play ball.
And cut.